Good evening, everyone. So yes, I'm going to give a talk. This talk has been a little difficult for me for a few reasons. I've never done it from a computer. I don't think I'm going to use the computer too much because I made some handwritten notes and I think I'll probably rely mostly on those. Just feels a little awkward. But if worse comes to worse, I'll do that. I prepared a talk beforehand. I made a lot of changes in it. It's been hard for me to figure out how to express what I would like to express, and I don't think I did a very good job of it, but here I am. I've done what I usually do in these situations, which is take a shower, put on a clean shirt and socks, and show up. And something will happen. Something will happen. Part of this talk is going to be about my personal experiences and relationship to the Buddha, which has been the hardest part to try to put into words. So I never know when I give a talk what's going to come out of my mouth, actually, no matter how much I've prepared. So I'm going to give this talk, and I do want to say that I'm viewing this talk as a gift. So I'm not just giving a talk to the air, I'm actually giving a talk to you with the intention in mind that it will be a gift that hopefully will have some interest for you and, more importantly, some use for you. Like any gift, you want it to be interesting and useful. My job is to try to do that. Your job is to listen and see what sense you can make and what use you can make of the gift. This talk has cost me a few restless nights, actually, thinking about how to describe my spiritual life. It's always difficult for me to do that, and I think it's always difficult for me to describe personal relationships, and this relationship feels like it's been even more difficult to find words for. So those are all my disclaimers ahead of time. I want very much to do this talk, and I want it to be whatever it would mean to say a successful talk, but I'd like it to be a talk that's useful for you and connects for you somehow with going for refuge to the Buddha. So, before I give the body of the talk, I'm going to give you the main points. So here's a summary of the main points ahead of time. And hopefully I will elucidate these main points a little bit ahead of time. But if there's anything worth taking notes about, you might want to think about it in terms of the mental notes or written notes. Of the main points as I see them that I'm trying to communicate. So the first main point is about going for refuge, and I hope I'll give some definition to going for refuge, underscoring that it's the defining and pivotal action of the spiritual life for a Buddhist. And I'll say a little more that going for refuge is a common and uniting act among most Buddhist traditions, that it's not a one-time event, it's a continuous dynamic act that nourishes spiritual development and also reflects spiritual development. So, although going for refuge might be a first step, in a way, in becoming a Buddhist, it's also a continual step. So I'll be saying a little more about that. And that going for refuge is a commitment. It requires, like any commitment, trust and action. If we put on the schedule that we're going to have lunch at 12 o'clock, you are going to trust that there will be a lunch at 12 o'clock. We're making a commitment to you that there will be a lunch at 12 o'clock, and we both take suitable actions according to that basis of trust. Well, going for refuge requires a very different kind of trust than that there'll be lunch at 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock tomorrow, but the same things hold for any commitment. There has to be a level of trust and a level of action, and both the action and trust reinforce each other, but if there isn't enough trust or enough action, there won't be a going for refuge. So the trust and the action in this case is focused on the Buddha, so I'll be talking some about that. The second main point is that so much about going for refuge to the Buddha, so much depends upon your relationship to the historical Buddha, to the Buddha. And I hope I'll be talking a little bit about not only my experience, but conveying to you the importance of you figuring out how you're going to develop a relationship. I mean, a commitment doesn't exist if there isn't some sense of a relationship, some sense of a connection. And everyone forms relationships according to their own nature. But I'll be spending a little time talking about mine, not necessarily because it's a model for you, but because it's how my experience through the various vicissitudes of things has been, how my relationship has evolved and why it's important to me. And the last point is, how do you express your commitment, you're going for refuge to the Buddha? How does it express itself? How is it felt, and how is it kind of evident, not only to you, but to people around you? How does it make itself manifest in your spiritual life? How does it renew itself? How does it develop itself? Those kinds of questions. So those are the main points, and maybe I don't need to say much else at this about this. No, I have a little more to say. I want to start off, first of all, by saying saranang, buddhang saranang gacchami. Buddhang saranang gacchami. We say those three words when we start to say the refuges. Those are the three words back to the time of the historical Buddha. They're Pali expressions that say, to the Buddha, for refuge, I go. Buddhang saranang gacchami. So I'm going to be talking about what those words translate into, a little bit historically, a little bit impersonally, and I hope mostly personally. Okay. I'm going to read a couple of bits about going for refuge from Sangharakshita. You've read this in the chapter that we're talking about. Finding my reading glasses. One goes for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, or in more contemporary idiom, commits oneself to them, when one decides that this is the most important thing in human life, and when one acts, or does one's best to act, in accordance with that decision. Although we have spoken of a single act, it is not an act that is performed but once in an individual's lifetime. At every stage of spiritual life, one must turn more and more radically from the mundane to the transcendental. This is going for refuge. Furthermore, that act does not take place simply in one department of life. It is a total act involving every nerve and fiber of one's being, having repercussions in all aspects of one's experience and activity. So I want you to recall the breadth of the impact going for refuge has. It reverberates throughout every corner of your being and every corner of your life. A little historical connection to this for the Buddha, because I'm focusing on the Buddha, other people are going to be focusing on the Dharma and the Sangha. These words, buddhang saranang gacchami, go back to the historical Buddhist time, and the image of going for refuge predates the Buddha. I mean, it was incorporated into the Buddhist tradition, but it was already existent prior to that, in the sense that apparently in pre-Buddhist India, it was not uncommon for people to... I'm going to move away from that distracting screen. It has a roll of pictures on it now, which are kind of distracting. So there was a kind of use of the word sadhanam, refuge, or sanctuary, or protection, in those relationships where somebody was willing to exchange their services, do something that somebody else wanted in exchange for their patronage, their protection, their taking care of them. So we have, prior to the Buddha, people going for refuge to powerful people, to various shrines and other things. Whenever there was a sense, not whenever, but often if there was a sense of insecurity, human insecurity, you know, we want to make sure we're going to be taken care of, that things are going to be all right. This expression, go for refuge, take refuge with a person, a force, that was already in effect. So this became automatically incorporated in the Buddhist tradition. And there is, in the Dhammapada, the Buddha talks about this in one verse. And he says, they go to many a refuge, to mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines, people threatened with danger. That's not the secure refuge. That's not the highest refuge. That's not the refuge, having gone to which you gain release from all suffering. But when having gone for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, you see with right discernment the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause of suffering, and the transcending of suffering, and the Eight Noble Path, the way to the stilling of suffering. That's the secure refuge, that the highest refuge. That is the refuge, having gone to which you gain release from all suffering. So there was a important transposition of going for refuge when it came to the Buddha. We're not talking about the Buddha being a god who intervenes and will offer material protection or taking care of people. We're talking about a going for refuge which brings peace to people. It's an internal and external going for refuge in a way, but the focus is on the internal going for refuge to the Buddha. We don't have expectations that the Buddha is going to be a protector in the sense that he's going to keep someone from harming us. He's going to, if we go to refuge for the Buddha, he may keep us from harming ourselves and may change our lives in such a way that hopefully we're going to feel peace. But he's not going to bring us material success. And apparently the word refuge was largely used, not uncommonly, in the sense of protection. Somebody will take care of you if you carry out their wishes. They'll make sure that things are all right for you. And you know, and I know, that human insecurity is an ocean, really. And that everyone wants to feel a little more security. I learned not too long ago that one of my favorite quotes, which is from Macbeth, about this, was probably not actually written by Shakespeare, but inserted in later by some of the people who changed a little bit and edited a little bit and added a little bit to some of Shakespeare's plays, including Macbeth. So there's a great scene early in Macbeth where Hecate, the queen of the witches, is talking with the other witches about how they're going to ensnare Macbeth by leading him to believe that his bloody ambitions are going to be foolproof. He's going to be absolutely secure. And in this quote, at the end of the discussion Hecate has with the other witches. She says, "And as ye know, security is mortal's chiefest enemy." Of course, we all want security, but it is our enemy in a way. And the heart, one heart of the Buddha's teaching is that the grasping for security is going to always lead us to trouble. Not as egregious trouble as Macbeth's belief in his security was, but in a way, the desire to be secure is always going to lead to trouble. And the Buddha's teaching is a different kind of security. Not about this kind of security. So, I just want you to understand the important transposition about refuge, protection, that occurs with the Buddha from the more traditional one. People went to shrines, people went to trees, people went to natural objects, prayed to them in the hope that they would be protected. Something good would happen. They'd be granted something that they wanted to be granted. I mean, we see that today in a way. Professional athletes, you know, take off on and off their batting gloves in the expectation that that will help them get a hit. Pitchers have rituals they go through in the belief that they're going to throw a strike. It's a deep part of our human nature, and almost all spiritual traditions have in them an element of wanting to provide people some security. The Buddhist tradition is very different than those. It doesn't offer people, if you, a contractual agreement where if you give me your loyalty, you will in return get a kind of security and immortal happiness, or your relative will feel better, you won't get sick, something terrible won't happen. It's not like that. This is a way of managing human suffering, really, which was the Buddha's central concern. So they go to many a refuge. Those are not the highest refuge. Those are not true refuges. And the Buddha is offering a very different, higher, more satisfying refuge that will lead to the release of suffering and stress. That will lead to a place of peace. And it is a sort of a contractual arrangement, if you think about it. I mean, it's a commitment that you make. But as I said, the commitment really needs to be based on trust and action. So I'm going to talk a little more about that. How would you know you can trust the Buddha, the historical Buddha? I'm talking about the historical Buddha now. And let me just say, everything traces itself back to the historical Buddha. That is the first, and probably why it's the first refuge. No Buddha, no teaching, no Dhamma. No Buddha, no disciples of the Buddha, no Sangha. The historical Buddha is a human being, not a god, but he walked the earth like you and me. But and we should take some comfort and make some connection to the fact that the Buddha is a human being. And I will say briefly, like you and me, but actually the Buddha is not like you and me. The Buddha is a human being, but not a human being like you are or I am. The historical Buddha, Prince Gotama, who became Buddha Gotama, was a remarkable being. I used to think earlier in my sort of relationship with the Buddha, understanding the Buddha, he's a remarkable being. I thought he was a remarkable sage, a remarkably wise person, a remarkably compassionate person. That sort of evolved into thinking he's not just a remarkable person, he's a genius. But I would say now that's evolved into thinking, actually, the historical Buddha became a perfected being. A being unlike probably any other genius. Scaled heights that you and I can't even see. Understood things that are very, very difficult for any of us to understand. He set out on a quest for truth. And he not only saw the truth, saw it in its full comprehensiveness and depth, which would be almost unimaginable, but he lived that truth and he taught that truth. So he was, in a way, a human being that came to an understanding, lived that understanding, and in a way that, again, is hard for us to imagine, was able to teach that understanding to other beings. So, in a way, this is a remarkable event in history. The Buddha had a long life. He had decades to teach his understanding. And he taught very seriously. He wandered. He gave discourses. He met people. He worked very, very strenuously with his own community of bhikkhus as well as lay people. But we must, I'm going to try to refrain from using the word must, but so take this as a sort of literal must. We must appreciate that the Buddha was really a very historically singular person. And his accomplishments kind of radiate over other accomplishments. I mean, we can think of geniuses, we can think of great people, and that they become even greater in through the lens of time and history. Some of that may be true for the Buddha, but we have enough, not just data, information, but we have enough of a feeling for what the Buddha did that we can see, I mean, his contribution, his way of being, his way of teaching were really remarkable, more than remarkable. So I think of the Buddha as sort of a human being perfected, an ideal being, a person that would be an ideal for me to look toward becoming. Which makes it easy for me to trust the Buddha, trust the Buddha's teaching. I'll say a little bit more about this in a couple of minutes. But I do want to say, going for refuge to the historical Buddha is the starting point. A little history will show you that it was very easy to make the step from the historical Buddha being a perfect being to becoming a being that, you know, suddenly jumped out of time and historical context. So there are mythic Buddhas. There are stories of Buddhas from eons, previous eons, and Buddhas from other cosmological systems. But all their roots in the Mahayana tradition, Vajrayana tradition, every tradition, trace themselves back to the Buddha Shakyamuni. So, Buddham Saranam Gacchami, to the Buddha for refuge I go, really has its initial reference to the historical Buddha. And that is where we begin, when we begin our taking refuge. Alright. Here's a little description from Ralph Waldo Emerson, not specific to the historical Buddha, but describes, in a way, an aspect of the historical Buddha. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great man is he who in the midst of the crowd keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. The independence of solitude, the perfect sweetness of the independence of solitude amidst the crowd. This is one description I always have in mind of the Buddha. He was himself, giving discourses, encountering people, giving teachings. His life was a very public life, but he kept with this kind of perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. And that is a characteristic of the great man, something we might all aspire to, but not by any means easy to do. So I hope you're getting my message about the Buddha being, yes, a person that walked the same planet that we do, but a different being than we are in a way, and a being that we can look toward as an ideal for what human potential can accomplish. Even looking at other beings who over centuries have been magnified by history, Socrates, Jesus, other people, they don't stand out as a human being who is able to accomplish and perfect the potential of a human being. I think there's a difference. Even though Jesus may be worshipped as a god, I don't know if he's viewed as a person who perfected all the human qualities that you and I have a potential toward. I'm switching gears a little bit now to talk about my personal history with the Buddha Shakyamuni. So I came to a meditation study group in 1989 in Concord, New Hampshire, taught by Manjivadra. After the meditation, we those who wanted to spent another hour doing an introduction to Buddhism. So, of course, I was interested in that. We studied a text, a book by Nao Subhuti. It was used as Alex Kennedy name at the time, A Buddhist Vision. That went on for 8 weeks. We continued it on for another 8 weeks. We continued it on for another 8 weeks. We continued it on for another 8 weeks. And we began to study some Pali canon along the way. We studied from the Udana, which is one of the earlier parts of the Pali Canon. That's where the Maggiya Sutta is that Dhammarati talked about last night, and that's one of the suttas that we studied. And in the Pali study, you begin to get a feeling, I began to get a feeling, for the Buddha as he was in his time. What he said, I mean, we don't know if it's what he said, but it's quoted as what he said. And the person that the Buddha was begins to emerge, as well as the Buddha's doctrine. And I became very drawn to the person and the teacher that the Buddha was, as well as to the content of his teachings. I mean, the content of his teachings would be enough, but for reasons I don't know, I felt very pulled to want to understand, well, the mind of the Buddha, as if that were possible, to see the world through the Buddha's eyes, to have a view of the world as much as possible that the historical Buddha had. Somewhere in the first 6 months, by the way, I first met Vajramati in this course in Concord when he first came. He visited us one or two times, I think. And we had become a smaller group that was really much more focused on Buddhist study. We did the meditation and then we really focused on Buddhist studies. And we encouraged Manjivadra to do more more study of the Pali Canon. So there was a retreat. The first retreat I came to here was one on the Pali Canon. And my first experience in the shrine room here was very powerful. There was a rupa, an image of the Buddha, which is now downstairs. As you come in, the door that goes up to the kitchen, it's on a table. It's a Buddha in an orange robe with gold skin. That was in the shrine room here for many years. It's my first years here. I saw it, the first time I saw it, I thought, that's a very beautiful image. It has a very human features to it. I mean, they don't look like image features. They could be a real human being without too much stretch. I could imagine real flesh. So my image of the Buddha for a long time was based on that rupa. I could picture the Buddha in this orange robe with this goldish skin and these very human features. So coming here more, I developed a kind of what I would say the beginnings of a personal relationship to the Buddha. I would begin to imagine conversations with the Buddha based on some of both the Buddha's teaching and some of the reading of the Pali Canon. And I found the Pali Canon just irresistible to read, so I just kept reading it. I'm no scholar. I don't understand all the scholarship involved in it. I know virtually no Pali or Sanskrit. I read the notes, you know, that go with the sutras, but some of them make no sense to me. Some of them that are more in English and are clear what they're referring to are wonderful because they elucidate some things. But I just was reading and reading and reading to get a sense of the Buddha's life. And it amazed me every time there would be discourses, people encountering the Buddha, talks with his disciples. So I'm going to read you a few in a minute. Not that these are necessarily the ones that struck me the most, but they reveal things about the Buddha that give you a sense of his existence, his life, who he was, kind of the person the Buddha was, as well as the teacher the Buddha was, as well as the Buddha in the sense of an awakened being. I'll do that in just a minute. So I've continued to do that. I mean, I read and reread. I have a book which I'm going to read you from called The Life of the Buddha, which is drawn from various suttas and from the Vinaya, it's arranged in chronological order. So you get a little, because the canon is not arranged in any chronological order, so you get a sense of the Buddha's life, and as much as Bhikkhu Nyanamoli was able to do it, sort of the evolution of the Buddha. I mean, the Buddha lived to be 80 years old. He was enlightened when he was 36. So there's like many decades of teaching. I'm not going to do the math. I think it's like 40 years, but a long time. And the Buddha was active through that whole time. When he made a commitment to teach what he understood, he kept that commitment. He was available to people. Some of the discourses are people that come up to him while he's walking in a grove. Some of them are even while he's walking doing alms rounds, which is kind of verboten, but I mean, people just approached him. And he would respond to them. And the breadth of experiences with people sprinkled through the Pali Canon is really quite remarkable. I mean, I don't imagine everyone would have the same interest I do. I think a lot of people don't find it that interesting, which is a little sad to me. But I realize I'm different than most people, and that's over the almost 70 years that I've lived, that's fine with me. I think one of me on the earth is probably enough right now anyway. So I'm just saying this to encourage you to find what you need to find as your connection. But I would have conversations with the Buddha as I imagined the Buddha. I would have questions for the Buddha and imagine how the Buddha might answer that. I'd be in difficult situations sometimes and think to myself, what would the Buddha do? I felt the Buddha as a real-ish kind of presence in my life. So it wasn't just like there was a distance. There was becoming more of a, you know, a real relationship. I mean, we're capable of, and you know this from your own experience, forming very important relationships with all manner of beings, some of which are not historically alive, some of them which are entirely imaginary. I mean, people form relationships with Hamlet, not with Shakespeare, but with Hamlet. People form relationships with movie characters or characters on TV series. I don't know, I don't watch too much TV, but I know people feel drawn into, like, Modern Family. I hear people talk about that at work, or other series, as if those people were real. So it's not a difficult thing. I think we're actually very susceptible to wanting to form relationships that somehow fit and meet our needs. Well, I had obviously some important need that my sense of the Buddha was fulfilling for me, and it's continued to do that. Actually, I mean, I always. In an instant, I can feel the Buddha's presence, which is very wonderful for me. I mean, I know it's a figment of my imagination, but then there's the question about what's real and imaginary anyway. I mean, Mickey Mouse is imaginary, but he's almost as real, more real than lots of human beings, actually. So I'm not trying to compare Mickey Mouse to the Buddha, by the way. So I'm going to give you a flavor for this, I hope, by reading you a few things and telling you how they have struck me. Now, some of these might seem silly to you, but I hope they won't after I read them. I'm jumping out of order now because I have another quote I don't want to pass up giving you, which really has to do with the Buddha. And it had to do with my response to the Buddha, which is very much like what Thoreau is describing here. He's talking about the feeling of waking up in the morning and the beauty of the morning, and that it's not so hard to make any hour of the day like the morning if you can transcend the sense of the clock. And then he goes on to say, the morning is so beautiful because you wake up, and there's a special feeling about waking up and a special feeling about the dawn and looking forward to what's coming, a kind of energy about that. The millions are awake enough for physical labor. But only one in a million is awake enough for effective intellectual exertion. And only one in 100 millions, I mean, the world was smaller in 1842 in Europe, the population was small. Only one in 100 millions to a poetic or divine life. To be awake is to be alive. I have never met a man who was quite awake. How could I look him in the face? I think of the Buddha when I think that, fully alive. How could I look him in the face? How could I look him in the face? So I do think of the Buddha as a fully alive, awake being, a remarkable, gifted person. Okay, so this one, in a way, has always seemed like kind of a a very interesting one, because it gives you such a very human situation and the Buddha's response in it. I doubt if you've read this. I've never read it anywhere except coming across it in the life of the Buddha here. Once, while the Blessed One was expounding the Dhamma, surrounded by a large number of bhikkhus, he sneezed. The bhikkhus made a loud noise, saying, "Long life to you, Lord! Long life to you, Lord!" The noise interrupted the talk on the Dhamma. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, when long life to you is said to someone who sneezes, may he live or die because of that?" "No, Lord." "Bhikkhus, long life to you is not to be said to someone who sneezes." So then, when bhikkhus sneezed and householders said, "Long life to you, Lord," They were embarrassed and did not answer. People disapproved, and they murmured and protested. How can these monks, these sons of the Shakyans, not answer when long life is said to them? Bhikkhus told this to the Blessed One. He said, I'm imagining the Buddha saying this, Bhikkhus, householders are accustomed to such superstitions. I allow you, when they say long life to you, to reply, may you live long. So these things touch me because I think, here's the Buddha. He's giving a talk on the Dhamma. He sneezes. This automatic response, like we say, God bless you, whether we even believe in God or not. People who are atheists will say, God bless you. They say, long life to you, Lord. It disrupts the talk of the Dhamma. But more importantly, the Buddha stops and says, what are you doing? Do you think saying long life to you is going to determine whether a person lives or dies? And they say, well, of course not. And he says, well, pay attention. Why would you do something that you don't believe? Why would you say something that you don't believe? So, of course, the monks take this literally. They're in the presence of householders. They sneeze. The householders say, long life to you. And they're embarrassed. They don't know what to do. And this, there's murmuring and protesting and disapproval. And they go back to the Buddha, and he has to help them think through the fact that they are his disciples. They can apply a little different standard. They can have compassion for householders. They can say, may you live long, back to them. There's no harm in that. There's no reason to offend people because you have a certain belief and practice. So that's from the Vinaya, and it's just an interesting insight to me. I love these stories like this about the Buddha. So here's another one that has a very different flavor. This is called this is from the Majjhima Nikaya, and it is called Wonderful and Marvelous. So I'm not going to read you the whole sutta because this is a little longer. Wonderful and marvelous. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. Now a number of bhikkhus were sitting in the assembly hall where they had met together on returning from their alms round after their meal. When this discussion arose among them, and so there's a long discussion about the wonderful and marvelous attainments and qualities of a Tathagata. How the qualities that were there before he's born, I'll read you a bit of it. They're having this conversation anyway, and the Buddha walks in. However, their discussion was interrupted, for the Blessed One rose from meditation when it was evening, went to the assembly hall, and sat down on a seat made ready. Then he addressed the bhikkhus thus, Bhikkhus, for what discussion are you sitting together here now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted? He walks in, they're talking. What were you talking about? Here, Venerable Sir, we were sitting in the assembly hall. Here we had met together on returning from our alms round after our meal, when this discussion arose among us. It is wonderful, friends, it is marvelous, the qualities of the Tathagata. So there are pages of these, what they discussed as they were recounting it to the Buddha. On the birth of the Buddha, he was born standing up. He took seven steps in each direction. There was a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods. And the beings born there, perceived each other by that light, because it penetrated into these, quote, abysmal world, interspaces of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where no light had ever penetrated before. Where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail. There are all these amazing qualities. So at the end of their recounting to him all the marvelous and wonderful qualities of these kind of superhuman qualities, the Buddha says this: "That being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. Hear, Ananda, for the Tathagata's feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they rise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Remember this too, Ananda, as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata." So the Buddha is suddenly saying, marvelous and wonderful, maybe those things are, but they, what's marvelous and wonderful is to be able to know your feelings as they arise, as they present, and as they disappear. Know your thoughts. Know your perceptions. I mean, this is the Buddha's basic message. So he kind of just turns the whole thing to the purpose of their leading a holy life, the purpose of their being his disciples, which is not to take away from their belief in his other wondrous and marvelous powers, but to focus on what really is truly marvelous and wonderful, that they can accomplish this quality. I'm going to stop in a minute. I'm going to read you one other, which I was thinking would be a good conclusion anyway. I'm skipping some other things. Oh, I have a few things I got to say before I read this. So how do you not just develop a relationship with the Buddha? So what if you develop it? So what if I've developed this? How does it manifest itself in my life? And how does your going for refuge manifest itself in your life? So here's the thing. You heard the quote. It's not like here or there, a certain aspect of your life. It's really a reorienting of your whole life. So when I first came to Aryaloka and was involved in some of these discussions, the sense was, this moves to the center of your life, and other things move to the periphery of your life. So we draw circles about where things are in our life. Very useful and helpful exercise. But I have come to feel something different than that. So, actually, I'm going to mangle a bit of a much longer poem by William Wordsworth to tell you how I experience my going for refuge and how I experience my going for refuge specifically to the Buddha. So this is taken from Lines Written About Tintern Abbey by William Wordsworth. And this is just a little piece of it, but it's the heart of it. And I've transposed a few words in it, you'll see. For I have learned, going for refuge to the Buddha, as hearing the still, sad music of humanity, not harsh nor grating, though ample, of ample power to chasten and subdue. And I feel a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air and the blue sky and the mind of men, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. So I think of my commitment to the Buddha, the response I get from my commitment to the Buddha is something that rolls through all things. So that means all things that are part of my life. I love my life's companion and partner. I couldn't love anybody more. I love my children. I couldn't love them more than any father could love his children. I love my grandchildren. Frankly, I loved my work. Those things didn't become less important to me, but everything in my life has slowly but steadily become more interfused with this going for refuge. It's like a light, frankly, that sort of goes everywhere. And the light itself, you know, light is magical. I mean, light is invisible, unseen. We know it's there because we see it reflected in the color and texture of objects. But we don't actually see light. But if there was not the light of my going for refuge to the Buddha, my commitment to the Buddha, and the response to my commitment from the Buddha, my world would be a very dim, gloomy world. I have got... It animates my world. Long life to you. Not that you'll live longer or shorter because of that. If you could, I mean, I'm being a little dramatic, but I think it's the difference between a moon that has a sunlight to reflect and a moon that would exist with no sun. It would be a dark cinder drifting somewhere in you know, endless space. The light gives it color, gives it brightness, gives it life. And that's to my grandchildren, to my life's partner, to my work, to my encounters with you, to this talk, to the extent that it feels like it has some life in it. It's this quality of something unseen but illuminating really every corner of my being. So I wish for you to be able to feel even a smidgen of that, actually, because it's a really, it's changed my life. Not the details of my life, but it's changed my life from the inside in a way that, I mean, I can't really describe any better. I've kept you a long time. I'm going to read one more bit to give you a little more of a sense, through my eyes at least, of the Buddha that I go to refuge for. So this is the Greater Discourse in Gosinga. I'm not going to read much of it. I'll just take a minute. If I can find my glasses again. So, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Nataka in a brick house. Oops, that's the wrong one. That's the shorter discourse in Gosinga. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the park of the Gosinga Sala tree wood, together with a number of very well-known elder disciples, the Venerable Shariputta, the Venerable Maha Moggallana, the Venerable Maha Kassapa, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Revata, the Venerable Ananda, and other very well-known elder disciples. And they're talking to each other, and it arises that this question comes up. Friend Ananda, this is between two of the disciples. The Gosinga Sala tree wood is delightful. The night is moonlit. The Sala trees are all in blossom, and heavenly scents seem to be floating in the air. What kind of bhikkhu, good friend, could illuminate the Gosinga Sala tree wood? So all these disciples take turns answering that question, all these elder disciples, and they all give an answer that describes themselves, what their particular practice is. So, for example, Sariputra says he teaches the Dhamma, such teachings as are good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, with right meaning and phrasing, which affirm a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. And that's what Shariputra did, and each one of them describes sort of themselves. They come to the end and they decide, let's go talk to the Buddha about this. And they tell him it's a beautiful night, it's Sala trees are in full bloom, and what everyone has said. And they say, Venerable Sir, this is Shariputra, which one of us has spoken well? And the Buddha responds, you all have spoken well, Shariputta, each in his own way. Hear also from me what kind of bhikkhu could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree, this Gosinga Salatri would. Here, Sariputra, when a bhikkhu has returned from his alms round after his meal, he sits down, folds his legs crosswise, sets his body erect, and establishing mindfulness in front of him, resolves, I shall not break this sitting position until through not clinging, my mind is liberated from the taints. That kind of bhikkhu could illuminate the Gosinga Salatri wood. Now, of course, that's what the Buddha did. But more importantly, if you think about this, you realize that each one of these elder bhikkhus talks about their own attainments after their own spiritual development, where they've come to. The Buddha is talking about you and me, nobody who's become an arahant, nobody who's attained enlightenment. He's talking about the very beginning, a bhikkhu who returns from his alms round after his meal, sits down, folds his legs crosswise, sets his body erect, and establishing mindfulness in front of him, resolves, I shall not break this sitting position until through not clinging, my mind is liberated from the taints. That's what we're all trying to do. That would illuminate this beautiful wood. The Buddha brings it right back down to the basic teaching that he wants to give. And of course, that is what the Blessed One said. Those venerable ones were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, I hope you're satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words as I'm passing them on to you. Thank you for your generous time tonight.